Well, good morning, everybody. How is everybody? Is this working? Is this pretty good? All right. Well, hopefully we will put the locusts to bed today. No more locusts. This is certainly the deep hand of Revelation and that whole concept of simile thinking. You describe something by what it's like, really begins to grate on us, because this is so wild sounding. So, I know Steve took a whack at it and we'll try to finish it, but a couple things to remember. In Revelation, you're experiencing kind of time, if you can call it that, in heaven. Really, you can't because there is no time in heaven. But there's this sense that we're understanding a single event told through many different lenses. So again, remember, it's not sequence. You know, all these events happen one after another. It's more like this event happens, and in a dream, it happens again, but you get different sets of details. So that's what they're doing. They're constantly describing the transition, the end of the world, the judgment of humanity, and God's sort of intervention. So these series of events, horns and horsemen and trumpets now that we're dealing with, it's all the same thing. So it will change at one point, but not for a while. Does that make sense? Okay. So remember the setup here in chapter 9, that God is himself intervening. He is taking the coals from the temple in heaven, or the altar in heaven, and he's bringing it to earth. He is bringing goodness back, baby. He's bringing holiness into the world. All the while, he was looking for the prayers of the martyrs, remember, those that had been killed, so that participation of humanity. He's looking for the Vav. We talked about that 2 weeks ago, that third portion that we're supposed to add. It's like I remember one time I was buying a Star Wars figure, very important in my life, at a Gibson's. Remember Gibson's? Oh yeah, that was like Walmart before Walmart, right? So I didn't quite have enough, and my dad was very generous, and so he was paying the extra difference. And I remember I was like, "Oh, okay, you can just pay Dad." And he's like, "No, you pay your allowance, and I'll cover what you're short. Not I'm going to buy it for you." And that's kind of what God is doing towards the end of all this. He's saying, I want humanity collectively, us individually as well, to do what we can, to have the seal we'll talk about today on our forehead. Having made the choice, we would say in modern sort of evangelical thinking, having accepted Jesus Christ in your heart. Now, John, because he's raised in the first century, raised in a very Jewish, Galilean kind of context, is going to view this in a apocalyptic way. Remember, that's not just end time stuff, but that is perceiving the deeper truth. And so he is really exploring this deeper truth with this angel, with God. So, chapter 9, verse 1, little repeat here. Then the fifth angel blew his trumpet. Remember, it's a shofar. And I saw a star that had fallen to the earth from the sky. Now that makes us suspect. And he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. The what? When he opened it, smoke poured out as though from a huge furnace, and the sun and the air turned dark from the smoke. Verse 3, the locusts came from the smoke and descended on the earth. So the angel heralds this event, a star, and you can pretty much take this to the bank. Stars are generally what in Scripture? They're what? Angels, yeah. There's a lot of discussion in the Psalms that each star has a name, it has a sort of identity, and they really are the angelic hosts of the heavens. So one has fallen. And we think, oh, we know this, right? Who is the most famous fallen angel? Yeah, but remember, he's not the only one. A third of the angels will go with him. Again, we have that third part. But then they begin to describe this bottomless pit. What does your translation say? Anything different for verse 1 and verse 1? Abyss. Abyss. Yeah, that's good. So this is one of those points when we realize the way we imagine the world is not the way John imagined the world. Although they may be closer than we appreciate. So can we throw up the cosmology bubble, the color one? Yeah. So this is really helpful. I need to print them so you can put them in your Bibles. This is generally how biblically they perceive the world, that we exist in a bubble. It's a bubble that is between dark, raging oceans. And if you sort of compare the idea of space to their oceans, we're not too far off when their conceptions. You know, they imagined that God separated out. He took the crazy chaos, and chaos is full of potential, right? Chaos can be made into anything, but in its state, it's unordered, and so it's dangerous. It's just churning and crazy. So a lot of the creation myth is this separating idea that we tend to run over. But so God separates the sense of chaos, and he creates this perfect little bubble where humanity is fit to survive, fit to grow. And again, I was listening to Elon Musk, and he's going to take us to Mars. Did you hear all that? In 2 years, I'm going to start launching rockets. But there's a big difference between a human trying to live on Mars and a human trying to live on Earth, right? So that's what they see here. So where we live, they call Hadets, the land. So that's the place of choice. That's the place of time. That's the place of blessing, really. And then you have Hashemayim, which is the two waters. It's their word for heaven. So there's sort of water above us, which is rain, and there's water beneath us, which are the springs and the wells and those kind of things. So they do imagine heaven to be more like a ceiling than we do. They know it's up there. In a sense, God's up there, but they know there's something beyond that as well. And that's again, chaos. When you go down, you have a place they call Sheol, the pit. And it's where you go when you die. And one of the very confusing things that happened is when we started translating the Bible into Greek, Sheol became Hades. And that's problematic because Hades has its own mythology within Greek thinking. Hades is a god, as in addition to a location. It's the Greek underworld. When a biblical passage speaks of Sheol, it's not generally talking about the afterlife or even the underworld or anything like that. They're just thinking of death, the pit. You know, the classic example, and you gotta love us as Christians. So the creed says, and he descended to the dead, or he descended into hell. You guys know what I'm talking about? Sort of the one of the versions of the creeds, he descended into hell. So when a Hebrew says that, he descended into Sheol, what does that mean? He's dead. He's really dead. He's dead, dead, dead. Okay. So that's all that meant. But when we say he descended into Hades, which we have a tendency to translate as hell, that's got a whole different connotation, doesn't it? Oh, we think Jesus is going down to hell and kicking butt and fighting and all that kind of stuff. So it's, you sort of got to know how they thought before we make all these assumptions about, so descended into the dead or all that, is just dying. So they imagine Sheol, and the older I get, the better I think just to leave that untranslated, to not make it Hades or hell. There is a hell, but it's not Sheol. Yeah.
So in the construct of this graph, where would hell be?
It's in the land. It's in Ha'aretz, which is confusing because Gehenna is. I better wait. I mean, it ends up being in the world because that ends up being in the place, but it ends up being in the future world because that place gets redone and it becomes New Jerusalem. So it's both heaven and then there's the sense of Gehenna, which is outside of the bubble. So when John starts talking about descending to the abyss, he's talking about that place beneath the land, beneath Sheol. It's the deepest place that they can go under. And it's full of, like, the darkness of chaos. One thing the ancients do much better than us is they separate evil from chaos. Can you guys sort of get the difference there? I learned this as a kid, a very simple way. So there's an Egyptian god for evil, and his name is Set. And he's kind of a donkey-headed god, and he's the one that killed Osiris and all that kind of stuff. And then there's a god of chaos called Apophis, which is a giant snake that tries to eat the sun every night. And even though, in a sense, they're both bad guys, they're very different kind of bad guys. One, Set, exists in the world, and sometimes he actually helps fight the serpent from the underworld. But Apophis is a whole different kind of evil. It's not just doing bad things. It's just complete destruction. So when they separate the abyss from Sheol, they're doing that. They're saying that God is releasing, not as we would expect, Lucifer, who is evil, the tempter. This is much more fundamental to existence. This is going back to, you know, the construction at creation, if you will, that hasn't been touched since the time of man. And God is unleashing something that has been down there before we existed. And that gets everybody's attention. Holy moly. We thought hell was bad. This thing is really terrible. So, does that make any sense? Clear as mud, yeah. So we have some interesting descriptions down there. It's watery, but we have this idea of a huge furnace and smoke coming out of it. What would a furnace possibly be doing down there? And this is sort of borrowing imagery from Gehenna, from hell. Yeah. Remember, hell is generally described by Jesus as a dump. It's not the place where Satan rules. It's a dump. It's where God takes all the evil of humanity, all the evil of the universe, and throws it sort of off a cliff. And like any good farmer knows, you have your junk pile, right? But what do you have to do periodically with that? You got to burn it. So that's the image, both of Gehenna, that the fires and all that that you're destroying. And the same idea here, that it's on an industrial scale that they're having to destroy the chaos, the potential that goes mad. And before I get too far away from it, how is the ocean described in earlier chapters of Revelation? Remember, God's throne is above a what? There's a river that flows to him. Yeah, it's living water. But remember, they talked about the crystal seas, which is definitely in reference to all this chaos, that whatever state we end up in with God as righteous, all of this, in their view, ocean chaos is done. It's a crystal clear sea. It's solid. So, like, it's almost like making dough. Right? Chaos is the dough. And you're going to make several things out of the dough that God did, but he kept some dough around. They're talking about here at the end, when God is doing away with the sense of time, the sense of humanity's evil, he's also getting rid of all of the extra dough. So there will be no chaos in the future. There is no potential for evil. It's coming to an end.
So when did the angels, when did Satan, one third of the angels, fall? Before or after Adam?
Well, that's asking sort of the wrong way, because you're still trying to make it sequential. And you'll see, they'll throw it in a chapter 12, that it happens outside of time. And so it interjects at points in time, but it's like asking when this happened. Well, it has happened and it is happening. It will happen, kind of thing. So, but we may have a day where we just talk about the time of Revelation, because it's really mind-boggling. But locusts, have anybody ever actually seen them in their glory? Yeah. It's nice to live in an industrialized country with lots of good pesticides. People want to return to nature. I'm like, I don't. I remember as a kid, it wasn't a plague, but El Paso had a lot of grasshoppers one year that was really dry. So, you know, it's the closest I remember as a kid. And they were at the airport, which was weird. And they were eating carpet at the airport. Just this lasting little image of me killing grasshoppers in the El Paso airport. It was great. But let me show you what it's like to live in a communist country. So in southern Russia, back in the 90s, they had a honest outbreak of locusts. You know, most of the time when we see it today, it's in Africa. But this actually happened in South Russia. So just to give you a sense of when they're doing their thing. I think we have a little video. I mean, it is absolutely overwhelming. Then you have dumb Russians catching them? I don't know. What do you plan to do with those? Yeah. But, I mean, just overwhelming, can't stop. They eat, destroy everything.
3000 banka.
Yeah, put a shirt on. We'd all feel good.
Very good. Huh? Very good.
Yeah. It's a lot of protein.
We saw one of those once in Ethiopia.
Well, good morning, everybody. How is everybody? Is this working? Is this pretty good? All right. Well, hopefully we will put the locusts to bed today. No more locusts. This is certainly the deep hand of Revelation. And that whole concept of simile thinking, you describe something by what it's like, really begins to grate on us, because this is so, so wild sounding. So, I know Steve took a whack at it and we'll try to finish it, but a couple things to remember. In Revelation, you're experiencing kind of time, if you can call it that, in heaven. Really, you can't, because there is no time in heaven. But there's this sense that we're understanding a single event told through many different lenses. So again, remember, it's not sequence. You know, all these events happen one after another. It's more like this event happens, and in a dream, it happens again, but you get different sets of details. So that's what they're doing. They're constantly describing the transition, the end of the world, the judgment of humanity, and God's sort of intervention. So these series of events, horns and horsemen and trumpets now that we're dealing with, it's all the same thing. So it will change at one point, but not for a while. Does that make sense? Okay. So remember the setup here in chapter 9, that God is himself intervening. He is taking the coals from the temple in heaven, or the altar in heaven, and he's bringing it to earth. He is bringing goodness back, baby. He's bringing holiness into the world. All the while, he was looking for the prayers of the martyrs, remember, those that had been killed, so that participation of humanity. He's looking for the Vav. We talked about that 2 weeks ago, that third portion that we're supposed to add. It's like I remember one time I was buying a Star Wars figure, very important in my life, at a Gibson's. Remember Gibson's? Oh yeah, that was like Walmart before Walmart, right? So I didn't quite have enough, and my dad was very generous, and so he was paying the extra difference. And I remember I was like, "Oh, okay, you can just pay dad." And he's like, "No, you pay your allowance, and I'll cover what you're short, not I'm going to buy it for you." And that's kind of what God is doing towards the end of all this. He's saying, I want humanity, collectively, us individually as well, to do what we can, to have the seal, we'll talk about today, on our forehead. Having made the choice, we would say in modern sort of evangelical thinking, having accepted Jesus Christ in your heart. Now, John, because he's raised in the first century, raised in a very Jewish, Galilean kind of context, is going to view this in an apocalyptic way. Remember, that's not just end time stuff, but that is perceiving the deeper truth. And so he is really exploring this deeper truth with this angel, with God. So, chapter 9, verse 1, little repeat here. Then the fifth angel blew his trumpet. Remember, it's a shofar. And I saw a star that had fallen to the earth from the sky. Now, that makes us suspect. And he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. The what? When he opened it, smoke poured out as though from a huge furnace, and the sun and the air turned dark from the smoke. Verse 3, the locusts came from the smoke and descended on the earth. So the angel heralds this event, a star, and you can pretty much take this to the bank. Stars are generally what in Scripture? They're what?
Angels.
Angels, yeah. There's a lot of discussion in the Psalms that each star has a name, it has a sort of identity, and they really are the angelic hosts of the heavens. So one has fallen, and we think, oh, we know this, right? Who is the most famous fallen angel? Yeah, but remember, he's not the only one. A third of the angels will go with him. Again, we have that third part. But then they begin to describe this bottomless pit. What does your translation say? Anything different for verse 1 and a verse 1? Abyss. Yeah, that's good. So this is one of those points when we realize the way we imagine the world is not the way John imagined the world. Although they may be closer than we appreciate. So can we throw up the cosmology bubble, the color one? Yeah. So this is really helpful. I need to print them so you can put them in your Bibles. This is generally how biblically they perceive the world, that we exist in a bubble. It's a bubble that is between dark, raging oceans. And if you sort of compare the idea of space to their oceans, we're not too far off when their conceptions. You know, they imagined that God separated out. He took the crazy chaos, and chaos is full of potential, right? Chaos can be made into anything, but in its state, it's unordered, and so it's dangerous. It's just churning and crazy. So a lot of the creation myth is this separating idea that we tend to run over. But so God separates the sense of chaos, and he creates this perfect little bubble where humanity is fit to survive, fit to grow. And again, I was listening to Elon Musk, and he's going to take us to Mars. Did you hear all that? In 2 years, I'm going to start launching rockets. But there's a big difference between a human trying to live on Mars and a human trying to live on Earth, right? So that's what they see here. So where we live, they call Hades, the land. So that's the place of choice. That's the place of time. That's the place of blessing, really. And then you have Hashemayim, which is the two waters. It's their word for heaven. So there's sort of water above us, which is rain, and there's water beneath us, which are the springs and the wells and those kind of things. So they do imagine heaven to be more like a ceiling than we do. They know it's up there. In a sense, God's up there, but they know there's something beyond that as well. And that's again, chaos. When you go down, you have a place they call Sheol, the pit. And it's where you go when you die. And one of the very confusing things that happened is when we started translating the Bible into Greek, Sheol became Hades. And that's problematic because Hades has its own mythology within Greek thinking. Hades is a god, as in addition to a location. It's the Greek underworld. When a biblical passage speaks of Sheol, it's not generally talking about the afterlife or even the underworld or anything like that. They're just thinking of death, the pit. You know, the classic example, and you gotta love us as Christians. So, the creed says, and he descended to the dead, or he descended into hell. You guys know what I'm talking about? Sort of the one of the versions of the creeds, he descended into hell. So, when a Hebrew says that, he descended into Sheol, what does that mean? He's dead. He's really dead. He's dead, dead, dead. Okay. So that's all that meant. But when we say he descended into Hades, which we have a tendency to translate as hell, that's got a whole different connotation, doesn't it? Oh, we think Jesus is going down to hell and kicking butt and fighting and all that kind of stuff. So it's, you sort of got to know how they thought before we make all these assumptions about, so descended into the dead or all that, is just dying. So they imagine Sheol, and the older I get, the better I think just to leave that untranslated, to not make it Hades or hell. There is a hell, but it's not Sheol. Yeah.
So in the construct of this graph, where would hell be?
It's in the land. It's in Ha'aretz, which is confusing because Gehenna is, I better wait. I mean, it ends up being in the world because that ends up being in the place, but it ends up being in the future world because that place gets redone and it becomes New Jerusalem. So it's both heaven and then there's the sense of Gehenna, which is outside of the bubble. So when John starts talking about descending to the abyss, he's talking about that place beneath the land, beneath Sheol. It's the deepest place that they can go under. And it's full of, like, the darkness of chaos. One thing the ancients do much better than us is they separate evil from chaos. Can you guys sort of get the difference there? I learned this as a kid, a very simple way. So there's an Egyptian god for evil, and his name is Set. And he's kind of a donkey-headed god, and he's the one that killed Osiris and all that kind of stuff. And then there's a god of chaos called Apophis, which is a giant snake that tries to eat the sun every night. And even though, in a sense, they're both bad guys, they're very different kind of bad guys. One, Set exists in the world, and sometimes he actually helps fight the serpent from the underworld. But Apophis is a whole different kind of evil. It's not just doing bad things. It's just complete destruction. So when they separate the abyss from Sheol, they're doing that. They're saying that God is releasing, not as we would expect, Lucifer, who is evil, the tempter. This is much more fundamental to existence. This is going back to, you know, the construction at creation, if you will, that hasn't been touched since the time of man. And God is unleashing something that has been down there before we existed. And that gets everybody's attention. Holy moly. We thought hell was bad. This thing is really terrible. So, does that make any sense? Clear as mud, yeah. So we have some interesting descriptions down there. It's watery, but we have this idea of a huge furnace and smoke coming out of it. What a furnace possibly be doing down there? And this is sort of borrowing imagery from Gehenna, from hell. Yeah. Remember, hell is generally described by Jesus as a dump. It's not the place where Satan rules. It's a dump. It's where God takes all the evil of humanity, all the evil of the universe, and throws it sort of off a cliff. And like any good farmer knows, you have your junk pile, right? But what do you have to do periodically with that? You got to burn it. So that's the image, both of Gehenna, that the fires and all that you're destroying. And the same idea here, that it's on an industrial scale, that they're having to destroy the chaos, the potential that goes mad. And before I get too far away from it, how is the ocean described in earlier chapters of Revelation? Remember, God's throne is above a what? There's a river that flows to him, yes, living water. But remember, they talked about the crystal seas, which is definitely in reference to all this chaos, that whatever state we end up in with God as righteous, all of this, in their view, ocean chaos is done. It's a crystal clear sea. It's solid. So, like, it's almost like making dough. Right? Chaos is the dough. And you're going to make several things out of the dough that God did, but he kept some dough around. They're talking about here at the end, when God is doing away with the sense of time, the sense of humanity's evil, he's also getting rid of all of the extra dough. So there will be no chaos in the future. There is no potential for evil. It's coming to an end.
So when did Satan, one-third of the angels, fall? Before or after Adam?
Well, that's asking sort of the wrong way, because you're still trying to make it sequential. And you'll see they'll throw in a chapter 12 that it happens outside of time. And so it interjects at points in time. But it's like asking when this happened. Well, it has happened and it is happening. It will happen, kind of thing. So, but we may have a day where we just talk about the time of Revelation, because it's really mind-boggling. But locusts, have anybody ever actually seen them in their glory? Yeah. It's nice to live in an industrialized country with lots of good pesticides. People want to return to nature. I'm like, I don't. I remember as a kid, it wasn't a plague, but El Paso had a lot of grasshoppers one year that was really dry. So, you know, it's the closest I remember as a kid. And they were at the airport, which was weird. And they were eating carpet at the airport. Just this lasting little image of me killing grasshoppers in the El Paso airport. It was great. But let me show you what it's like to live in a communist country. So in southern Russia, back in the 90s, they had a honest outbreak of locust. You know, most of the time when we see it today, it's in Africa, but this actually happened in South Russia. So just to give you a sense of when they're doing their thing, I think we have a little video. I mean, it is absolutely overwhelming. Then you have dumb Russians catching them? I don't know. What do you plan to do with those? Yeah. But, I mean, just overwhelming. Can't stop. They eat, destroy everything.
3000 банка.
Yeah, put a shirt on. We'd all feel good.
Very good. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of protein.
I saw one of those once in Ethiopia. Down
there. Oh.
Just come wave after wave. You think it's over. Here comes another plow.
Yeah. Scientists tell us they can be in the millions, which I don't know how you count. One, two, oh, I forgot. Start over. But John is telling us it is like this. Okay? Hold on to that. It is like this. They pick horrible things from humanity, their experience, and he's trying the best that he can, being a Jew raised in Galilee, living in the first century, remembering apocalyptic literature, writing in Greek, okay? He's doing the best he can. But he imagines, the angel shows him sort of out of the destruction of this abyss rises this swarm of locusts. So the locusts came from the smoke and descended on the earth, and they were given power, a sting like a scorpion. That's something I've never seen. They were told not to harm the grass or the plants or the trees, but only the people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. Wow. I mean, that's sort of total countercultural to what we expect, that the locusts are going to eat all of the living grass and whatever, and get their little mandibles around. Here, it's people. And they sting like scorpions. We've talked about scorpions before, but again, John's taking images, things that he's seen, and describing sort of when the chaos that God has held back is unleashed on us, nature becomes this tormenting tool, this struggle for those that don't have the seal of God. Remember, we've talked about this. This is the number. This is God writing his name on your forehead. If we're back in Ezekiel, this is God making his mark on your forehead. Again, this is what we would say, accepting Jesus in your heart. So without the connection to Christ, chaos affects you. It hurts you. Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. No, that's a great analogy. Yeah, that hopefully the doorpost of your soul has been marked. Yeah.
Or you shoved after.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's funny we do that, and you know, 99.9% of people have no idea what we're doing. So, you know, come up, let me smear mud on your head. Okay. But hopefully we get this image here that what makes a difference between how chaos can affect us versus a life with Christ. And has anybody been stung by a scorpion? Yeah. How would you rank it in terms of... Yeah, I used to get stung by paper wasps all the time, just playing outside, knocking their nests down, monsters. But then I got stung by a scorpion, and that seemed worse to me. Then in El Paso, everybody, oh, let's put rocks on our yard. Oh, it's so great. You know, we don't have any water. Rocks, rocks. Well, it's like a Motel 6 for scorpions. They're like, woohoo, get to live here. So... the first house I owned and took Jason home to was still a swamp air conditioner. So, so the scorpions in the desert could sense the moisture. And so the stinking things would crawl up on my side of my house and they'd get in the air ducts because there's moisture and then they get blown out. And of course, like everybody, we had that, sort of beige carpet and these little yellow scorpions, you can't see them. And so we'd have to literally take a black light. They show up like crazy with a black light. And I found a couple on his floor in his nursery and one on the ceiling, which was the big fear that they'd fall on his crib. But luckily he never got bit. But they are terrible. All right. Verse 5, they were told, it's interesting, they're told not to kill them, people, but to torture them for 5 months with pain like the pain of a scorpion sting. In those days, people will seek death, but will not find it. They will long to die, but death will flee from them. Okay, so who's doing this? God. Yep. He opened the basement that we